Hello, I'm a grateful believer in Jesus Christ, and I'm in recovery for the use of internet pornography. My name is Jim. So I am the second child of five that was raised in a loving Catholic home by my parents, who celebrated just over 61 years of marriage this past year, prior to my father passing away this April. They both provided a stable home environment for the five of us children. I grew up with all my needs met: food, clothing, shelter, and security. Yet I vividly remember times of tension and stress whenever my parents sat down each month to pay the bills, which I internalized as a young child as there not being enough money. I carried that fear throughout my growing up years and into adulthood. The fear of there not being enough, whether it was money, time, love, or attention, was something that I've had to work through in my work here in Celebrate Recovery. I'll say more about that later. So my dad had grown up in rural Idaho and had experienced the loss of his mother when he was 16 after a long and painful battle with cancer. Other than her early death, I didn't hear many stories of my paternal grandmother growing up, but in later years, I learned that she was in excruciating pain in the years that led up to her death, and that my dad would cope whenever she would scream by leaving the house to escape that painful environment. I can see in reflecting on my upbringing that I inherited some of the coping mechanisms of withdrawing when dealing with conflict and emotional pain. My mom grew up as the oldest in a family of four kids, with two raging and abusive alcoholic parents. Growing up, I was aware of the alcoholism in my mother's family as her mom, my maternal grandmother, had gained sobriety after divorcing my grandfather and by attending Alcoholics Anonymous. She celebrated over 20 years of sobriety before a death at the early age of 61. I was not aware of the other severe abuse that happened to my mother until she addressed it in recovery after I had left home for college. That trauma and abuse had unconsciously colored her behavior as I was a young boy growing up. She was also raised in the South in the 1950s, which meant that the expected polite response to abuse for a young woman was to smile and say everything is fine, even when it's not. One dynamic that I vividly remember from my child is my mother often smiling and saying everything is fine while stress was building up inside her. But later in the day or later in the week, she would hit a tipping point and explode in rage with yelling, swearing, and sometimes slamming of cupboards and doors. My siblings and I would immediately head outside or to our rooms while my dad would intervene to calm her down. It was a pattern that regularly repeated itself, and I internalized that fear of triggering an outburst and carried that fear into my adult relationships. As a very young child, somewhere between the age of 2 and 5, I learned to change who I was to be what my mom needed me to be for her not to get angry. Some of the messages that she communicated whenever she lost her temper was that I was lazy, selfish, and not doing what I was supposed to do. At a very young age, I learned that conflict should be avoided at all cost. I learned how to do whatever it takes to avoid conflict and to try to prevent those outbursts of anger. I would try to be good, and when conflict arose, I would apologize and take responsibility for everything, or suppress what I wanted or needed in order to preserve harmony. In the process of adapting to that environment, I lost touch with my own needs and my true self. I didn't like to feel those uncomfortable feelings, and I would cope by immersing myself in work or look to escape in food, alcohol, or sex. For me, I didn't want to feel uncomfortable or overwhelming feelings. I would either look for a physical outlet in the form of playing sports, shooting baskets, running, etc., or I'd get busy with work, Overwork was socially acceptable, and the accomplishments gave me positive recognition and praise, which further reinforced my behavior of getting busy when experiencing feelings that I wanted to avoid. It was also a reaction of being labeled as lazy in my youth. Another behavior I would use to feel better was to eat, especially sweets like ice cream, candy, and cake. For much of my life, I had a high-calorie metabolism that allowed me to use food to comfort without having any negative consequences like weight gain. That stopped being true in my 40s, and now it's an area that I am addressing, checking in with myself to see if I'm trying to avoid feelings when reaching for food or eating when I'm not hungry. My vices to avoid feelings have been food, alcohol, sex, and work, which has interfered with intimacy and closeness in my most important relationships. However, I do recognize God's hand in helping me over the years to reject certain habits, addictions, or vices. For example, around the time of age 10, I stole a pack of non-filtered Camel cigarettes from my grandmother's suitcase and smoked the whole thing in 30 minutes and became sick to my stomach. Never to be able to stand the smell of cigarette smoke again, even to this day. Or when I was 14, working on a farm and was thirsty, and one of the older guys gave me a big snuff of Copenhagen chew, only to get sick, lose my lunch, and never touch it again. Or there were two occasions in college when I overdid it with alcohol, only to get terribly sick and not repeat that behavior. At that time, it didn't cause me to give up alcohol, but it did rein in getting stumbling drunk. Alcohol has played a part in lowering my inhibitions with food and sex, and as a result, I must be consistently vigilant and honest to interrupt negative behavior from my hurts, habits, and hangups. More recently, with the onset of COVID, I developed an irregular heartbeat, atrial flutter, and then AFib that required surgeries to correct. So with that, I stopped drinking alcohol. As a young boy, I was full of energy, never eager to sit still, and full of life. I loved to play, run, and laugh. When I was 6 or 7, I was sexually molested by an aunt of mine who was a teenager at the time. Up to this point, I was very innocent about human sexuality and did not experience feelings of lust or shame. But following that experience, I was confused and overly aware of my sexual impulses and often filled with shame. I told no one of that experience, as she was family and that wasn't something the family talked about. I grew up with a passion for sports. My dad was a football and baseball all-star growing up, earning a sports scholarship in college and becoming an All-American, and eventually playing minor league baseball. I always looked up to him and wanted to excel at sports. In grade school, in middle school, I enjoyed playing basketball and baseball. From my dad's example, a big part of my identity centered around sports. My freshman year of high school, I grew 6 inches and became uncoordinated and slow, barely making teams I tried out for. It was difficult not to feel hurt by the rejection and the ranking at the bottom of a team and watching games from the sidelines. But by my junior year, my body caught up with my growth and I began to excel at sports. I took pride in going from the guy on the verge of being cut to being a starter and receiving recruiting letters for small colleges my senior year. Sports became a way of getting recognition and acceptance, as well as a physical outlet for stress. God and the church were always a part of my life growing up. I was baptized into the Catholic Church as an infant, went through First Confession, First Communion as a second grader, then received confirmation in eighth grade. I continued my Catholic education at an all-boys high school, attending retreats my junior and senior years that were transformative in my spiritual growth, as well as my relationship with my classmates. I had a prayer class my junior year that helped me develop a personal relationship and prayer life with Jesus Christ. Being skinny most of my growing up years, I found myself shy around girls when I was in middle school, as I wasn't that muscular, handsome, or confident guy I figured most girls were interested in. Later, in high school, I did date and had a serious girlfriend my senior year and into my freshman year of college. I enjoyed the feeling of being in love and the affection my girlfriend and I shared. After being away from home my freshman year of college, I could see that the two of us were too different to be together long term, so I broke it off. Later that year, I met a young lady who'd been married and divorced at a young age. She came from a broken family and was hungry for approval and affection. I viewed myself as someone who could fix her pain and one who could show her love and respect. I would gauge my own worth by how she felt about me and about life in general. Within 6 months of our dating, I started to realize that I was feeling tremendous pressure to be her everything and that her happiness was dependent on me. And as I was 19 years old, it was more than I could handle. I broke off our relationship and found myself depressed. As the fall trimester ended my sophomore year, my depression, sleep deprivation, and drinking at an end-of-term party landed me in a state where I was exhausted and in a fog, where I could not tell what was going on in a conversation or interactions with others. That experience scared me. I went home on break, and my parents asked how things were going at school, and I told them much of what I was experiencing. Loneliness, spiritual isolation. I would open the Bible and find it dry and arid, feeling like I was the only Christian at school, although I wasn't living it, and emotionally exhausted. My parents asked if they could lay on hands and pray over me. Now, my parents had been actively involved in the charismatic renewal in the 70s, and when I was in high school, I told them, "That's okay for you, but I'm not interested in laying on of hands or speaking in tongues or other Pentecostal experiences." But at this point, because I was at such a low point, I surrendered and said, "Sure, why not? It can't hurt." They prayed over me and asked for God to bring Christians into my life who would support me and help me grow in my relationship with God. A week later, when I returned to college for the winter term, I was at my desk doing homework when my roommate said, "Hey, there's a new Bible study starting up with a minister from the United Evangelical Free Church here on campus. Would you like to come with me?" I said yes, grabbed my Bible, and out the door we went. We started with the Gospel of Mark, and the words just left off the page and spoke straight to my heart and quenched a deep thirst. Much of the scripture I'd heard growing up, but it laid fallow, and now it sprouted and flourished. I developed strong relationships with the people in the Bible study, and we became close personal friends, truly an answer to the prayer my parents had prayed when I'd been home on break. For the next 18 months, I intentionally decided not to date, as I needed time for my own personal growth and healing. I grew in my relationship with Christ and found fellowship with a close group of Christian friends through the remainder of my college years and beyond. We still get together every summer. My ex-wife and I met each other at church. I was in formation with the Franciscan religious order to become a Catholic priest. And she was in the church choir and had signed up to serve in the Peace Corps in the Dominican Republic. For those who are unfamiliar with the Catholic priesthood, it requires men to profess a lifetime of celibacy and to forego being married. While I thought that God might be leading me to the priesthood, I struggled with the idea of not having a wife and children. I wanted to hold a woman and to be held. Her and I would get to know each other in the continuing months through activities of the church, through prayer services, serving dinners, youth ministry, and serving in the homeless shelter. In the early spring of that year, I left the formation program and my future wife canceled her trip into the Peace Corps. Later that fall, we were married, and the following year, we welcomed our son into the world. 2 years later, our daughter was born, and we were complete as a family. I worked in the high-tech industry, and my wife was a stay-at-home mother and homemaker. We raised our kids, got them through college, all while having our ups and downs as a family. My first experience with pornography came in the form of magazines that I came across at relatives' or friends' houses throughout my youth. My first time viewing a magazine was during my middle school years. I found it stirred up lust and a distorted view of human sexuality and beauty. It wasn't something I sought out, even in my early adulthood, as I wasn't comfortable going into a store to purchase a magazine or go to an adult video store and check out material. It wasn't until internet pornography became available that I found myself viewing pornography with any regularity. Each time I viewed pornography, I would feel guilt and shame and would vow not to do it again. I'd go to confession and then abstain for another 30 to 60 days until something would happen that would have me feeling things I wanted to avoid: rejection, anxiety, fear, loneliness. I would turn to pornography as an escape. Looking back, Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 7, verse 15, really resonated with my life. I do not understand my own actions, for I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing I hate. In the fall of 2014, my wife and I were taking a marriage enrichment class at church that was developed by a Christian counseling organization. As we attended classes and worked through the chapters of our workbook, we arrived at chapter 7 about honesty. The author asserted, quote, "No area of your life should be kept secret. All of your spouse's questions should be answered fully and completely." So on November 8th, 2014, I shared with my wife that for the past 6 to 8 years, I struggled on occasion with pornography use. She was devastated by the news and deeply hurt by my unfaithfulness. In my mind, I'd compartmentalized pornography usage as a thing completely disconnected from relationship, as an inanimate object. For my wife, it was the same as another person coming into our relationship. It was a betrayal of my marriage vows. For the next few weeks, we were not able to live under the same roof as the hurt was too deep. I sat down with my adult kids and my daughter-in-law and confessed my struggle with pornography and the resulting hurt to our marriage. As they were all young adults, my wife and I were not going to pretend that everything was okay between us, and I took responsibility to explain the cause of our separation. Now, with hindsight of working a step study, I would advise getting counsel from your sponsor or see our leader prior to sharing with extended family members and possibly impacting them. Each person's situation is unique, thus it needs wise counsel from a sponsor. We received a recommendation from a Christian counselor to begin sessions with the hopes of healing ourselves and our marriage. After a couple of meetings, he suggested going to a meeting at a church in Boring, Oregon that has small groups for guys struggling with pornography and for their spouses who have been impacted by it. Through some searching, we found a meeting at Good Shepherd Community Church in Boring. After attending the first meeting, we discovered there was Celebrate Recovery communities across the Portland metro area and found one closer to home, landing at Rolling Hills Community Church in Tualatin. I've been going here ever since. I attended a step study later that spring and found a sponsor. Through the step study, I could work through many of the hurts I'd experienced throughout my lifetime. I was holding on to resentment and unforgiveness that I had not examined. The format of the step study allowed me to share freely with my brothers in Christ who listened, loved me, and journeyed with me as I worked through the muck and the mire of my life. It was very healing during step 4, lesson 8, to not only create a searching and fearless moral inventory of the wrongs I had done, but also the list of positives. As Lamentations 3:40 says, "Let us examine our ways and test them." I examined all my ways, both the good and the bad. This balanced approach of listing the good things I'd done in my life, in addition to the areas where I needed to confess and make amends, was extremely helpful in my recovery. When I got to step 9, we made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. I recognized it was too late as it related to the confession to my wife. I had bluntly gone and confessed to her without understanding the impact it would have on her. While I gained freedom from my secrecy and shame, it came at a huge price to my wife's serenity and to her heart. If you're a newcomer, and walk through these doors for the first time, or someone who has not yet done a step study, please find an experienced sponsor and learn from their wisdom and counsel before acting on some of the 12 steps, especially step 9, making amends. Each person and each relationship is unique. There's not one solution or right approach that works for everyone. That's why the program has paired us with sponsors who can pray with and guide us in our specific circumstances. Working through the step study on my hurts, habits, and hang-ups, I now address feelings and thoughts as they surface. Through the incredible fellowship and support of guys in my small group and my step study, I no longer isolate when I'm having a hard time. I no longer put pressure on others to provide all my emotional needs. I reach out to the guys who support me and get the support I need. In the past, I would have isolated and not risked rejection from other men. But through this program and building up of trust, I now have guys that love me and support me. As I was working with a Christian counselor, he used the metaphor of crashing into the ditch on the side of the road for failing to uphold commitments and giving up sobriety. He asked me to examine what things are on the shoulder of the road that can lead to the ditch. For me, it was using alcohol when I was alone. It was surfing the internet, especially sites that target men, like sporting sites with suggestive advertising, social media. And it's not reaching out to others when I'm hurting. In the CR program, we refer to these things that could cause us to go in the ditch as triggers. I have a job that occasionally requires travel. Being on the road can create feelings of stress, loneliness, and isolation. For those times when I travel alone, I've attended CR meetings in other cities and benefited from the fellowship while I was away from home. While it takes time to look up meetings, scouting them in advance and making a commitment ahead of time to go is a good way to set up a successful trip. Other things I've done is to ask the front desk, and this is kind of dating it, to disconnect cable TV when I check in. I have accountability partners back home that are praying for me and that I check in at the end of every day. I discipline myself to go to bed at a reasonable hour. Each of these steps have been a tremendous help to avoid triggers in my life. For those of you who've known me the past few years as being married, you may have noticed that I referred to my ex-wife earlier in my testimony. Unfortunately, in June of 2024, my wife and I went through a divorce. After years of individual counseling and couples counseling, my wife asked for a divorce. We worked through a mediated legal process to come to an agreement for the divorce settlement. While I wouldn't have chosen that path, divorce, I am graced by God, working through my recovery group and the great men He's brought into my life in the past 10 years. I can be honest and transparent with them each week to get much needed prayer and to have fellowship to sustain me during the challenging moments of the process. Through the counseling I've received over the years, I'm much better at feeling my emotions as they emerge, allowing them to flow and then to ebb naturally. I'm in touch with my authentic needs and wants and take ownership for my emotions and actions. This has brought great relief and a sense of peace. As I feel my emotions, I don't need to find ways to suppress them or avoid them. God is amazing and has touched my heart through the love of my recovery family. I'm so thankful to have found Celebrate Recovery. The weekly meetings and small groups where I can share my ups and downs without judgment have been healing and affirming. I'm thankful for my accountability partners who hold me to my word and encourage me on the journey. And to the guys who act as my sponsors and respond to texts or calls when I hit a patch of rough road. If this is your first time in Celebrate Recovery, keep coming back, as it is loving and a healing community. Thank you all for listening.